Accession number 20094, reel 18.
George Lester, reel 18.
Went back to Collingwood and was employed on general maintenance duties. It came up to my last week in the Royal Navy, last week in July, and I was busy doing things like returning my toolkit, saying goodbye to some of my friends. The divisional officer, my divisional officer, sent for me and he said, your B-13 is imminent. Now, the B-13 is a document originated to authorise the captain of the ship or establishment where you are to promote you to the next higher rating for which you've already qualified. You go on the advancement roster, and the B-13 is the official notification that you have reached the top of the roster and are now able to be promoted. Well, the division officer said to me, he said, your B-13 is imminent. So I said to him, I said, well, if when I see the captain tomorrow on the final interview, he wishes to rate me to Chief Petty Officer Radio Electrician on the strength of what you just told me, I will sign on for the further 10 years and also take up the option which I declined in February 1952 to go on the mechanician's course as a chief radio electrician. This was a 2-year course, I think I've already mentioned it, which really turned you into an artificer. But you couldn't be called an artificer because of the rules of the Artificer Association and everything else. You had to do your artificer apprenticeship. It is noted that the course that I declined, I was going to go on the founder course, the initial course, that most of the radio electricians who went on that course, most of them had the opportunity, and quite a few took it for a commission. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to stay in, I might as well try and make the most of it. So he said, well, I don't think we can do that without the B-13. I said, well, I said, that's my terms. And as I say, other than that, I said, because my wife really doesn't want me to stay in the Navy. She hasn't said so as such, but with two young lads to bring up, and knowing that she was left alone with the two young lads, and I hadn't seen the youngest one till he was nearly two, she didn't look upon it too favourably, and I can fully understand that. He agreed with me. So on the 30th of July, I saw the captain of Collingwood. He wished me all good success in the future. He shook my hand. And the next day, on the 31st of July, I went to a demob centre and was given a civilian suit. Demob suit, and which they put into a very, very thin cardboard box and tied it up with the thinnest piece of string that you can imagine. I feel certain that if I had to travel to Scotland, the box and the string wouldn't have made it. But luckily, I came home. And that was me. Finished with the Royal Navy. I would watch at Collingwood. I'd been receiving phone calls in the PO's mess in the evening from the from Phil Knowles, the group leader at Decca, saying, "When are you going to come? When are you going to come? We need you." And so I just took a week's leave, a week off, and went to work for Decca Radar Research Laboratories at Tolworth.
Did you find it difficult to adjust to civilian life afterwards?
Yes. Yes, bearing in mind that I'd been away from home from the age of 13, virtually, by the TS Exmouth. What happened was that I tried very much to get accommodation over in the Kingston, Richmond, Twickenham area for my wife and my two boys. But nobody wanted to know. You go to apply to any housing committee to get a council place, so I didn't have any real savings to put money down to buy a house. And they just didn't want to know. I didn't even want to know in Dagenham either.
Why not?
Oh, well, no, you weren't a resident here. I just spent nearly 15 years in the Navy. Oh, that's not our problem. And this is the kind of attitude I got. When we moved to... When the our group at Decca was so successful, the display group, these fish hall displays, that we were made into a display and data handling division. And they moved us to a new industrial estate at Hersham, Waltman Hersham. We went down there and I thought, well, if they've got a new industrial estate, they're bound to have some accommodation down here. So I applied to them. I also applied at Twickenham. By the way, I was staying during a week with my stepfather and coming home at weekends, which is almost like being in the Navy, being away from home during the week. But anyway, Twickenham didn't want to know. I'd left Twickenham when I joined the TS Exmouth in 1939, and they said, "No, you weren't resident. You were living with your parents," and they didn't want to know. Tolworth, the Kingston Tolworth area, they didn't want to know. No, you weren't resident here before you joined the Navy. Walton and Hersham, I went and saw them there, and they explained to me, "Well, we're having a housing committee meeting in 2 weeks' time, and we'll see if we can put you, we'll make a decision to see if we can put you on the housing list." So I didn't hear anything in 2 weeks, so I went round there, phoned them up and went round and saw the woman. "Oh yes, you had a meeting." She said, "No, we can't put you on the list." And I've spoken to other ex-servicemen and they met exactly the same response. Down here, eventually, they said, "We'll put you on the housing list, but your points total is so low that you'll, it'll be about 7 or 8 years before you get a place."
That's in Dagenham?
That's in Dagenham, yes.
So how did you get a house in the end?
Well, my mother-in-law was living in here. It was a rented house, and she was living here. And with the fact that I couldn't get anything over the Kingston area, and my small gratuity I got from the Navy, I'd spent from the, on top of this, for my salary was insufficient, really. I decided that I'd have to, even though at Deggers, I progressed from lab assistant to assistant engineer grade 2, assistant engineer 1, and then to engineer status. My salary had gone up, but it was still insufficient for me to put enough by to buy a place. And that's why eventually I wrote to English Electric to see if I could come and live here and work at Chelmsford. I wrote to English Electric at Chelmsford, and they put my letter through to Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company, and I attended an interview there, and they accepted me, and I lived here. What happened was, this block, there was privately owned, rented accommodation. And what happened was that the person who owned it died. And they were going to sell it to another company. And the chap was walking around, looking around. Then I saw him at the front, and he said, I'm just having a look around. He said, would you mind if I came inside your house just to see what the inside of the house looked like? He said, I'm looking on behalf of the prospective buyers. So I said, yes, come on in. And came in there. And I said, well, if they're going to be sold, is there any chance of it being bought by the people and the living here? He said, yes, I would think so. I make inquiries. And the next thing I know, my mother-in-law and myself, we bought the house. She is the sitting tenant. Mind you, before that, we were paying the rent and everything, you know. But we bought it as sitting tenant. And that was for some 35 years ago.
Did you have any other problems adjusting to civilian life in the sense of leaving the regulation of the Navy?
Initially, yes. Until I got into the swing of it, I was always a bit careful with those immediately superior to me, you know, in the strata and the offices and things like that. But gradually I developed into the, well, they're only human, the same as what I am, and possibly I have skills that they haven't. And so I adapted. Sometimes adapted quite strongly.
But I was thinking that in the Navy, everything is regulated for you, everything is controlled, whereas outside it isn't.
Some difficulty at first. But, you know, you soon adapt to the different environment of strict control to it's up to you what you do with it. There is a change like that. And it's something which I think now they do something about in the Navy, but in those days, nothing. When you finish your service, you were just pushed out and left to fend for yourself. I think this is why the Navy used to get a certain percentage, I don't know what it was, I think it must have been about, I would estimate, between 15% or so people who left the Navy after their first 12 years and had gone back in, rejoined again within 6 months, gone back in because they couldn't adapt to the different forces on one's life as opposed to your daily orders and what you had to do and your routine and things like that. It's a totally different ball game.
You mentioned this gratuity. On what kind of service was it based?
It was a fixed grant. It wasn't a fixed there. It was a £100 gratuity.
Regardless of the length.
Regardless, it was when you finish your 12 years man service, you've got £100 gratuity.
So the extra 3 years didn't make any difference.
Well, the boy service, or no, boy service didn't count. It didn't count for anything except that when I was a boy, I was doing a man's job.
How do you feel now about having served in the Navy all that time?
I don't think, if I hadn't gone into the Navy, I don't think I'd have had the quality of life and standard of life and I don't think I would achieve anything because I learnt a tremendous amount. Because when I joined the Navy as a boy, I was still under further education, and I still maintain that the most adaptable period in anyone's education is after the age of 15, where you can your mind seems to grasp things better. I'm talking about the time before the war and at the beginning of the war, when the school leaving age was 14. And it was only on rare occasions in certain grammar schools that you carried on to 15. But I was in full-time education from the time I joined the TS Exmouth, which is very good. And I think you may have heard from John Goddard about that. I was in full-time education from the TS Exmouth right through when I joined the Navy. I was in full-time education and it was quite a complex one because I was being trained as a board telegraphist, so therefore I had to learn maths to a much higher degree than I would have done in under normal circumstances. And that went on till I was 16 and a half.
Did your naval service leave you with any long-term effects?
Yes, it taught me, it really taught me to think for myself. Because if you go back on these tapes, you'll find that in many instances, I was my own boss. I had to work, in lots of cases, on my own initiative, responsible to somebody, ultimately, but in lots of cases, I had to work on my own. So it did teach me. I won't say it would teach everybody the same way, but personally, I found it. It did teach me how to battle things out on my own.
Have you kept up any connection with the Navy since you were demobbed?
Initially, No. When I first left the Navy, I was too busy finding my feet. But in recent years, well, for the last 18 years, 19 years, I have been a member of the Royal Naval Association. In actual fact, for the last 15 of those, I've been the chairman of the Dagenham branch of the Royal Naval Association. I belong to the HMS Nelson Association, the battleship HMS Nelson Association, and I belong to the HMS Morecambe Bay Association, which is my last ship. Nelson being my first, Morecambe Bay being my last. I'm also a member of the George Cross Islands Association through the actions in the Malta Convoy pedestal. So, yes, I have. Though, before joining the RNA, I was not a member of any active association, I was always very keen on the anything in relating to the Royal Navy. In actual fact, in 1962, I was hoping to form part of the team from Marconi's that went down to Portsmouth to go aboard HMS Mounts Bay and HMS Morecambe Bay, my last ship, where they were having tenders to refurbish all the electronics and radar gear prior to the ship's sail to the Portuguese Navy. That's what happened to the Mounts Bay and the Morecambe Bay. They were sold to the Portuguese Navy. And I was hoping to be able to go down, and I said, well, I know the ship, but unfortunately my work on the I was heavily engaged then on the NATO early warning program. This was a task of putting in radar stations, high power reporting stations and control reporting centres from North Norway to Eastern Turkey, all the way around, as a consortium of Marconi and Thompson CSF. Marconi were the prime contractor. Later on that there, the NADGE program came out with the NATO Air Defence Ground Environmental Scheme, came out, which put more stations in on that route, linked them to central controls and things like that, and also update all the NATO early warning stations. So I was the deputy program manager for the NADGE program at Marconi's. That was a consortium that was run by Hughes Aircraft Corporation, which had Telefunken, Selenia, and Marconi in the consortium. After that became the Group Chief NATO Air Traffic Control Contracts. But for the last 4 years, I was a manager of repair services, and most of my something like about 75% of my repairs were to naval equipment, mainly the GWS-25, IFF Mark 10, and other radar equipments that Marconi has supplied. That's where they used to send them back for repair, and I was responsible for the repair organisation that did all those.
Coming back to the Navy, what mm-hmm. did you think of relations in the Navy between ratings officers and petty officers?
In my particular branch, well, both my branches, because originally I was the communication branch, we were a small, tight-knit community, and we got on very well together. That's the chiefs and the petty officers leading, and the leading telegraphers and that, because we worked together, and we had to. It was a team effort. I was always treated, even as a boy telegraphist, and this is, I'm very grateful for this, that I was always treated as a member of the watch bill. I was treated as a man, which I appreciated very much. When I changed the electrical branch, as you've heard, a lot of the time I was on my own, but on board the on my last ship, the Morgan Bay, again, we were a very, very tight-knit community in the radio electricians branch, radio electrical branch. There's an REA radio electrical artificer, myself, and one LREM and one REM. There's just a small little group, and we never worked ships routine. When I say whenever, if the equipment was working or that, we could go ashore. If we were required on board, we were on board. We took our leave when we could, our shore leave when we could, and how we could. We didn't have a red or a green station card. We had a blue one, which meant that we were special duty. So therefore, there. Relationships during the war between the officers there was, well, I found very good, because you had a lot of RMVR officers who were just in for the war and everything else. But for a short period after the war, morale got very bad, because a lot of the diehards in the Navy tried to go back to the peacetime routine, pre-war peacetime routine, which didn't go down well, because the majority of the ratings were now, shall we say, better educated on lively matters, and better educated educationally as well, and they didn't take very kindly. I know that the morale on the Boxer fell drastically. You could tell that by the amounts of punishments that were being dished out when we returned to UK in 1945. A lot of the ships come to your ratios and looking at their demob numbers. And as continuous service ratings, we were just wondering how soon it was before we were going to be drafted abroad to replace those that whose demob was coming up. And but you could see that the morale there was getting very low. It was very low in barracks at that time. In actual fact, I don't know what it was like there and there, but I know when I left UK, I found it very good, because we went to Colombo first of all, and then on Stonecoast WT station. That was the relationship. Again, it was a team between the chief of the station, us leading trolls, and the officer commanding. It was a team effort. It was very good.